Boker Tov, everybody. We got started class 117 in our ongoing series on the Siddur. Hopefully we'll get through parts of this, of the second paragraph of the Shema. I'll mention at the end, and then I'll send out an email. But please God, next week I'll be broadcasting from Yerushalayim, which means the shiur is going to have to be earlier. So I don't know if it'll, I asked my son to find an early Mincha Minyan so I can make it 15 minutes later, but, I'll let you know the exact time, but it'll be somewhere between 8:15 and 8:30. We'll start this year, please God, next week. I'm going for a week to Israel, but, okay. Anyway, so I'm going on a solidarity mission, I guess, and whatever. Okay. We should hear good news. What can I say? All right. Let's continue. We discussed last week, we spent a lot of time talking about Asarat B'Tevet and when we should end the fast on Friday. And we just, you know, we touched upon on the end of, you know, the Shema that, we sort of finished the first half of the second paragraph. The first half is the good half. You know, if we listen to the mitzvot, everything will be great. And, God will give rain. Of course, that's part of the question. We didn't really talk about this. So I guess we were alluding to it. Really, we're talking about now. The Torah doesn't mention the Mashiach. The rewards of the Torah are very material. You know, you think the reward for observing mitzvot is, wow, you know, all these amazing things are going to happen, and spiritually, and miracles, and the Messianic era, and who knows what, and the world to come. And, of course, the Torah is very mundane. If you listen to the mitzvot, your animals will give, you know, they won't miscarry. Even your animals won't miscarry. And you'll have lots of crops and things. Oh, it's a little bit, you know, really? That's it. That's the great mitzvah for doing, for keeping the Torah. So yeah, that's the great reward. The great reward is that life should progress. We should be normal. We see now how important that is. You know, you have good food and good, a nice home, and, everybody gets along. That's the greatest reward. You don't need rewards of, that is the Messianic era in kind of a sense. You could also, the Rambam takes it a step further. The Rambam assumes that really the ultimate reward is, you know, the greater reward, the spiritual reward, the world to come, etc. But no, the Torah is going to talk about the average person, not what the Torah is talking about. No, so that's one aspect that the average person can't relate to these things. And normal people, what are we concerned about? How well the economy is doing, how the stock market is doing, at my job. That's normal. And that's fine. But the Rambam really in Hilchot Shuvah stresses another point, and that is the idea that when things are going well, then we can develop our spiritual side. Maybe not everybody wants to, but it's very hard when you're worrying about where your next meal is going to come from, or God forbid, in time of war, it's very hard to concentrate on the spiritual pursuits, on Torah. And it's a misconception that, you know, Jews thrived in poverty. It's really not true. All the great works, and there's the reason that Talmud Yerushalmi, nobody studies the Talmud Yerushalmi really. It's not authoritative, like the Bavli, nowhere near. Because it never was finished, because they didn't could edit it, because life was too difficult in Israel and exile. That's it. When people wrote things, when they were comfortable and they had a clear mind and a clear physical, they could be clearly spiritual. And we know, I don't know if we know, many people are perhaps unaware that basically, let's say when the yeshivot began in 19th century in Europe, but really only wealthy people learned in yeshivot. The reason we have a kolel now, that every Tom, Dick, and Harry learns in kolel, is because we're so rich that the community can afford it. You know, they have enough balabatim who give millions of dollars to all these yeshivot, so they can afford to have all these people learning. But that's an anomaly. It was in the 19th century. First of all, the yeshiva were much smaller, and generally only wealthy people learned. The Soloveitchik family was poor, but there was an exception. Then it began changing. In the 20th century, it changed. Rabbis were poor, but only wealthy people could afford to send their people to learn. Everybody had to go work at the age of 11, 12. So that's wealth is even from a spiritual point of view. So when the Torah says you'll have beautiful rewards and the rain and food, that's it. That's it. For those just, you know, basic stuff, want, you know, life, whatever, are not so concerned with spiritual things. But those who are concerned with spiritual things, this is the mechanism. Without it, we cannot have that. I think it was reading in Yisrael Tashma's book. I think in Ashkenaz, he's Yisrael Tashma. I don't know how many people have heard of him. Anybody here? Yisrael Tashma.
Yes,
He's not living anymore, but
in
he was the yeah. He was the head of the manuscripts at Hebrew University, the library. I had him. He taught me when I was in Beit Morasha for a year. Yisrael Tashma was really a Gaon Olam. Really, he knew everything, and he was a tremendous, you know, scholar, an academic scholar. And but his specialty, he wrote on Minhag Ashkenaz, you know, development of Ashkenazic Jewry. Written some fascinating books. He wrote on the Bala Maor. So I think he was the one who wrote that in medieval Ashkenaz in Germany, you know, the time of Rashi, Tosfot, you know, in subsequent generations, it was common that one person in the family, and only one person in the family, would, you know, would spend more time learning if they could, because and the rest of the family would go and support that person. Who could afford to, you know, everybody sit and learn? And the idea, you know, the average person today, the average graduate of a day school who doesn't spend a year in Israel, the average graduate of a day school, you know, with all our complaints on you know, on the school, knows way more than the average Jew knew throughout history. Way more. The average Jew throughout history was a total Amaretz, and many of them couldn't read, and we have lots of evidence about that. And we've mentioned often that the idea that an average Jew would study Talmud was inconceivable. Inconceivable that normal people, quote unquote, would study Talmud. Talmud was an elitist book. I mentioned many times, I can send you the article right there, that Talmud was written by rabbis for rabbis, which is why they can insult one another and they can have all kinds of things. And when you learn Daf Yomi, you sometimes come across these passages and you want to fall off your chair. You can't believe people said these things because we know in every profession, people talk in a certain way to their own, that they would never talk to outsiders. So never in a thousand
in
years.
In Torah.
I'm sorry?
In Chemach in Torah.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Of course, that's what the Rambam is saying. In Chemach in Torah. But I'm saying that throughout history, nobody studied Talmud. 2-3% studied Talmud. And it wasn't on the agenda. It wasn't considered important. Listen, the Rambam himself says it's not important. The Rambam says it's not important to study Talmud. That's why he wrote the Mishnah Torah. You have to know what to do. You have to know how you learn Talmud. You can learn all of Daf Yomi, 8 cycles, and you don't know what the halakha is in anything. Because almost never does the Talmud, I don't want to say almost never, but rarely does the Talmud come to an actual conclusion. The Talmud, you know, debate. It's the process. So the Rambam says, you don't need all that stuff. I'll just tell you, here's what to do. Just read my book and spend there, if you have time, spend it in philosophy. So that's, anyways, but that's just the way it was. It all changed after World War II. We became the wealthiest community in world history, that we've never been wealthier. Even the poor are wealthy, you know, relatively speaking. So therefore we, you know, we expect everybody to get a day school education and everybody to spend a year in Israel, and because more and more. Okay. And then now we're learning Kolim, all these things, a year in Israel, Kolim, that's in the last generation. Like who in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't, how many yeshivas were there in Israel in the 60s and 70s? When I went to yeshiva in Israel in 1979, there were 5 yeshivot. That's it. Now there are 500, you know, for American kids go. There were maybe 300 of us in Israel, maybe less. There was, whatever. Anyways, but it's interesting and telling that the Torah's rewards are very mundane, but mundane is good. And that's beautiful. That arranged in this, it's proper time. So that's, we can gather our grain. We discussed the debate, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but the simple meaning, and as the Gemara says, we follow Rabbi Shmuel, you gather your grain and you work and everything should be nice. Now, the second half, of course, we switch. Hishamru Lechem, that's where we got up to. Hishamru Lechem, guard yourself. And we know that in biblical Hebrew, Shamor always means a negative, right? Zachor and Shamor on the assert of the bread of Shabbat. Zachor is the positive commandments, and Shamor is the prohibition to violate the 39 categories of work on Shabbat. But Hishamru Lechem, Pen Yiftel Levavchem. So what does Pen Yiftel Levavchem mean? What does Yiftel mean?
Seduced.
I'm sorry, how does...
Seduced.
Be careful lest your heart be tempted. I didn't hear what you said, Gershom.
Seduce.
Subdue?
Seduce.
I'm sorry, I your sound is not coming through.
Avoid
Seduce. seduction.
Oh,
Seduce. Seduce.
seduce. Right, so good. That's not how they translate it here, but right. Kifta, when a man seduces a woman, that's the word we used. Yifateh. So pen yifteh levavchem, you'll be seduced. So here, yeah, the Koran translates it as tempted. I don't have an art scroll. If anybody has an art scroll in front of them, just curious how the art scroll translate it. But basically, the way the commentaries explain what was going to happen, our heart is going to open up. What does that mean? We're going to get too wealthy. In other words, the blessings that the Torah just told us about, that we're going to have wonderful material blessings, will hurt our spiritual sense. And this is, of course, a very common theme in the Torah. This is basically Sefer Dvarim. What Sefer Dvarim is Moshe Rabbeinu preparing the Jewish people to enter the land of Israel. And 100 times he tells the people, God, you're going to build nice homes, but be very careful. Don't let your riches go to your head. We got fat and we kicked away, or Ram Levavecha, your heart will get too bloated and you'll become arrogant. And that's over and over again. What's interesting is the Torah tells us if we do the mitzvot, we will be blessed with wealth. And that's a wonderful thing, despite the challenges that it will have. Basically, I don't think you need any commentaries to tell us this. I think it's basic common knowledge. Although, I don't know, maybe not. That the challenge of wealth is a much greater challenge than challenge of poverty. Poverty is very sad, but in terms of one's religious growth, it's rarely a challenge. Matter of fact, often poverty is an incentive for people to become more religiously motivated. Wealth, of course, we know, besides the amount of time you have to spend, the more wealth you have, the more time. Marbe nachasi, marbe daga. You have to be worried. Somebody who doesn't invest in the stock market doesn't check the stock market every day, I assume. And whatever. But the Torah, we know that wealth has challenges. Because mainly the Torah says, that my strength brought me this. We'll forget about we're partners with God. And for every person who is materially successful, there's 10 other people who are just as smart and work just as hard and weren't blessed. Because many times, so much of our success, our fact is beyond our control. I mean, COVID, everything proves that. There's so many factors in the world, it's impossible for anybody to control all the factors. So it's mazel, hakol talui b'mazel, even the Sefer Torah, the Aaron, the Zohar says, even which Torah they take. So if you're wealthy, it's mazel. It's not, hard work helps. But hard work is no guarantee, and some people who don't work hard or get really lucky. So but those who get wealthy, they forget about that. It's easy to, it's hard to remember. It's really hard to remember. So wealth is very dangerous because you're going to ascribe it all to your own good. So that's a spiritual, or that's a sort of a theological problem, that you won't recognize God. Okay, fine. All right, but then you have also the character problem. The person who becomes very wealthy very often is going to become arrogant and looks down on people. Everybody knows that. And the we are, the wealth and happens. Not everybody. So if you can, Baruch Hashem, though there are exceptions. But as a rule, and it's hard not to. Like, obviously, people are successful, have a lot of money. Everybody looks up to them. It's another problem. That's who everybody honors. And matter of fact, the Torah is so well aware of that. There is a halacha, that the Kohen Gadol, let's say, if I want to put into modern terms, who's the Kohen, who are the Kohanim of today? Are the rabbis? Or the Kohen that has to be, for sure, the Kohen Gadol has to be wealthy. Gadol, you have to raise him above the people. You have to give him honor. He has to be wealthy because people don't honor wealth. I think Rashi says it, the next week's Parsha, or in, what's he says it by, a poor person. It says it somewhere in the beginning. I don't remember where. Somewhere in the beginning of Shemot, that the quotes in Gemara, ani chashuv kemet. A poor person is considered like dead. Like nobody who cares. Dead. Nobody cares what a poor person has to say. So that's the way life works, for better or for worse. And therefore, wealth can be very character debilitating. Nonetheless, nonetheless, one second, Jeff. I'll get to you in a second. Nonetheless, We daven for wealth. I think it's such a beautiful idea. Yes, there's a challenge, but we can overcome it. Wealth is also wonderful. I talk about all the negative sides. There's so many wonderful things. Without wealth, we couldn't do all the things we do, and the causes we support, and the education, and so many beautiful, wonderful things, and the Balei Tzedakah. It's amazing. So we pray for wealth, despite knowing that being wealthy is more dangerous from a spiritual point of view than being poor. Nonetheless, we take on that challenge because it can be better. So we pray for something that's more risky because it's so important. Yes, Jeff, what did you want to say?
I thought always the point about the Kohen Gadol or whoever being wealthy was, or the judges, you can't bribe them. I thought that was the
right
point.
So is there a special halacha that a judge has to be wealthy? That I don't know. I know it's said by a Kohen Gadol. Yeah, you cannot bribe a judge. A judge is not allowed to get paid. I mean, that doesn't mean today can't take it means today that a judge has to be on salary, which is the way the Western democracies work. I don't know if the Beit Din always works like that. Any Beit Din that you pay for per case, the judge get paid per case, you don't want to go to such a Beit Din. That Beit Din is invalid. That's in Choshen Mishpat, the section of Shulchan Aruch that deals with monetary law. Basically, it opens up with the laws of judges. It says any judge who takes money for a judgment, his judgment is worthless. And the Torah, the rules of Shochad your hair will stand on edge. That's one of the reasons we don't like to do a real deen. It's impossible to follow it. If you say good morning to a judge, if one of the litigants walks in and says good morning, and the other is 10 minutes late, that's it. He has to excuse himself. That's what the Gemara says in Ksuba. He has to, he should excuse himself from the case because he's already bribed. Well, yeah, everybody knows. If you study now all the books on behavioral economics and psychology, we know the biases and all the confirmation bias and the availability bias and the thousands of biases that people don't know. One of the key people in the field, Daniel Kahneman, who, of course, was Israeli. He, by the way, set up the Israeli army. He was the first psychologist in the Israeli army and set up a lot of how we assess people to know what units they go to. He must have been in his early 20s at the time, because we're talking the early 50s. And he then went to Princeton, won, of course, the Nobel Prize in economics. And he was the one, he wrote this amazing book on, Thinking Fast and Slow about, all these biases that we have, the subconscious biases that we all have. The Talmud was apparently well aware of them. And the Talmud therefore understood that if one litigant said hello to you and the other didn't, that's it. You can't see clearly. That's why, so it's an amazing thing. So to have true judgment is really hard. So the Shulchan Aruch says that a judge who gets paid is invalid. So we know today, the same way you're in theory not supposed to take money for teaching Torah, and Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that it's forbidden. It's forbidden to teach Torah without getting paid. Amazing. Wow. I violate this law very often, that you're forbidden for teaching Torah without getting paid. I don't think Rav Moshe means that some guy who gives a shiur, who's a lawyer making $300,000 who gives a Tuesday night shiur and shul, has to get paid. Although maybe, I don't know, but that means obviously that someone said, no, I'm such a tzaddik, I don't want to get paid, I want to be poverty. No, as Rabbi Riskin said, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. So we have to pay people today. But yeah, it's an obligatory, it's an obligation, not you're allowed to pay people, you're obligated to pay. And you have to pay well. I mean, spoken already about it, how what a sickness in society. We're paying a baseball player $700 million. I mean, what a sick society that we live in. We don't have enough money for basics, but for baseball players, I don't blame the Los Angeles Dodgers, whatever. That's what the market, it's the market dictates that. So we have a sick market, amoral market. What can I say? But so you have to pay well. So the same thing, a judge has to get paid, but he should get paid on a salary. He can't get paid per case because get paid by the litigants. And it's already dangerous because, if you get paid, I don't want to get into it, but, people know churning hours and those lawyers, I don't want to pick on lawyers, but everybody, people who charge by time, lawyers, accountants, very often they'll spend more time. They can make more money. That's a big problem. So they should get a fixed salary irrespective. But anyways, that's, I don't know how this come up on biasing people. Yeah. Money is the shochet. So yes, because people respect money, that's what I'm saying. The Torah understood people respect money. The Kohen has to be wealthy. It's good if the judge is wealthy too, I guess. It's good if the rabbi's wealthy, because then the rabbi is not, you know, hurt. So, I don't know what that means. You have to pay the rabbi more money. I mean, again, it's very easy for a rabbi to say, I think rabbis should be wealthy. But it means that, people should be able to do things not with the pressure of money. Unfortunately, everybody has pressure of money. That's life. And, that's why the Talmud says, if you don't teach your child a trade, you teach him how to be a thief. One who doesn't make enough money to live semi-comfortably is going to cheat on their taxes and going to cut corners and cheat their competitors and, you know, dishonest. That's just the way it is. The Talmud recognizes that the problem today, it's so hard. You can make $250,000 and be poor because you got to pay $100,000 in day school tuition every year. It's a big problem. I've spoken about it many other times. I don't want to focus on that.
I have to leave now, not because you knocked the LA Dodgers.
I'm sorry. Listen, the Toronto Blue Jays were apparently the other team in hot pursuit. That's what they say. Do I know that the two teams were the Dodgers and the Blue Jays? I'm happy the Blue Jays didn't get them. Not that it matters. Of course, ticket prices would go up, $20 a ticket to pay for it. But not that I go to games, but whatever. I think it's a sickness in society. You know the famous story when Babe Ruth, right? Everybody knows that story. Who knows? I don't have to say. Who knows the Babe Ruth story? Put up your hand in the chat box, right? Sorry? Gershon, you know the story with Babe Ruth?
No, I don't.
Apparently in 1932, he hit, I don't know, you know, when he hit 60 home runs in 1927. So the record before Babe Ruth was, I don't know, 20 home runs. Like he smashed the, it was like, wasn't, you know, Babe Ruth was in a league by himself. So, apparently in 1932, he asked for a raise, for the Yankees. I don't know who the owner of the Yankees was back then. And he says he wants $80,000 a year. Now, okay, in 1932, what's $80,000 of 1932? Probably $1 million today. I don't think it's much more than $1 million. If Babe Ruth was playing today, he'd be making $1 billion, not 700 million. He'd get a $1 billion contract. But anyway, so the owner said, are you crazy? $80,000, that's more than the president of the United States makes. So Babe Ruth famously said, I had a better year. Yeah, everybody knows. Tova, you knew that. Us Canadians know about baseball stories. So today, no major league player makes less than the president of the United States. You can be 190. You can be the worst player in the major league baseball. You can sit on the bench the whole year. The minimum salary in baseball, I somebody can check it out while I speak. I don't know, $800,000 a year minimum salary. What does the president make? $400,000, whatever. So every single baseball player makes more than the president of the United States. That tells you something. The world has changed since 1932, and not for the better. Anyways, okay, let's get back here. We're talking about the Shema. But yes, this is what the Torah focuses on in Sefer Devarim. Don't let money go to you, because that's what money does. Nonetheless, we pray for money because money's good. It's good. And the greater the power of the good, the greater the power for evil. That's true about everything. That's Newton's law of physics, and every law in the physical world has a spiritual corollary. And whether you eat Rice Krispies or cornflakes, that's no moral difference. But how you use nuclear energy can destroy the world or save the world. So the Torah can be the greatest thing in the world, can be the worst thing. Religion can be the worst thing in the world. You know how many people are, look what's going on now. Hamas is a religious movement in theory, all right? It's religion can kill and destroy, and it's because it's so powerful. It can do so much good that it can do so much bad. So money is a similar idea. Anyway, so the Torah says, be very careful. When is your heart going to get big and seduced? And it's going to be when you have a lot of money. That's just the way life works. And therefore, you're going to worship other gods. And God will get angry. So it's very interesting here. God will get angry. Minimum baseball salary, thank you, Zev, is 700. Oh, with that, that wasn't a bad guess. Okay, $720,000. Oh, gosh. That's the minimum. I don't know how many people make minimum. Shelly, you have your hand up. You've got a quick question.
How would you put... Why doesn't the Torah give rules for the average wealthy person like it does for the king? Not that Shlomo didn't violate all the rules, and we know what happened.
The
with
Torah
that.
Does give the 613 mitzvot. Those are the rules for average for everybody. That's not okay. No one person can absorb 613 mitzvot. There are special. Everybody has the basic rules of the Torah. Then we have special rules for women and special rules for men and special rules for Kohanim and special rule for judges and special rules for kings. The more power a person has, the more rules they have to have. So I don't know if that applies to men and women also, just thinking, you know, now totally off the top of my head, you know. Well, I mean, women are exempt from, in theory, mitzvot aseh shehazman grama. They're more exceptions in the rule, but, whatever. The more power one has, the more restrictions one needs. So maybe a man needs more rules than a woman needs because men have more power than women. And for sure, a king needs the most rules. And, the king needs so many rules that the Abarbanel and others say, we don't even want a king. Right, that's the famous debate. The Rambam says, Rabbi Taub spoke about a little bit last night. The Rambam says it's a mitzvah to appoint a king. It's one of the three mitzvot we have when we come to Israel. Appoint a king, wipe out Amalek, and build the Beit HaMikdash. But others disagree. And others say, no, a king is terrible. The Torah, it's like if you can rape a woman in Eshet Yipat Torah, you go to war so you can take a woman captive. You think the Torah likes that? The Torah thinks it's terrible. But the Torah knows that the other option is worse. Rape is worse. I didn't read the article, but I understand the New York Times has a lead article on the sexual abuses on October 7th. It's a horrific article. They have all the evidence and, you know, the sexual abuse. So we know what goes on in war. And, the Torah wanted to limit that. So the Torah gave you an out. It doesn't mean, because it's a mitzvah in the Torah, it doesn't mean the Torah thinks it's good. There's a mitzvah to get divorced also. It doesn't mean you should get divorced. It means if you get divorced, this is how you have to do it. So we may not even want a king. The Rambam wants a king because there's too much power. And therefore, the Torah had all restrictions. How many? Okay, to us, it sounds like a joke. But a king was limited to marry 18 wives, right? That's the famous Gemara. It's a debate, really, but 18 wives. Okay, so we laugh. But in the ancient world, that's no joke. And Takayus, as you said, take a look at Shlomo HaMelech. So, right, judges have power. Anybody who has power, the Torah knew power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and the Torah therefore wants to put limits on our power, and the mitzvot are limits. Every Shabbos, we limit all human creativity to know that man is subservient to God. That's why we have Shabbos every week. We also have Shabbos, and the same idea, it's very different, a different angle, so our slaves can be free, right? That we can't make workers work. So it's the same thing. Just it's a different way of saying the same language. To recognize God and then to ensure your workers aren't enslaved is the same thing, just different words to say the same concept, you know, the application of that. So that's what we have every Shabbos to remind us that the man shouldn't get blown, you know, all full of himself. The problem is that it doesn't work so well. And works a little, does work a little, but we often don't how often do people talk about why we do mitzvah, why we keep Shabbat? When's the last time you heard somebody give a shiur on the theology of Shabbos as opposed to Hilchot Shabbos? You can go to anybody, you know, Borer, and then you how do you eat the fish, and with the watermelon, do you have to take out the pits first? Okay, it's very nice. But we are too much into that. Halachat minuet, we are too much into it. It's like Rav Lichtenstein. I remember years and years ago when Rav Lichtenstein came to America once. So that was the height of the tuna fish debate, whether OU tuna fish is kosher because there's dolphin meat. I don't want to get into the whole thing. And Rav Lichtenstein just commented how, like, he's living in Israel. Like, it's very sad that the number one thing people talk about in Judaism is if tuna fish is kosher. You know, we lose sight of the big picture so often. There's been a tremendous awareness of halakha, but I think, in many ways, I hate to say it, too much of an awareness of halakha, that sometimes the details can get in conflict with the overall meaning. They're both important. I don't know exactly where to draw the line, but I know this sounds really heretical, but, if you talk to real gedolim, they weren't so every little halachic detail. They don't follow everything in the Shulchan Aruch. They know what's really important and what isn't important. And, you know, and there's leeway to do things, but okay, you have to be a Torah scholar to know how to do that. But we don't spend enough time, but that's what the Shema is really telling us every day. Just read the Chumash. Don't read Midrashim. Read what the Chumash says, right? Read about the Avod and the Imahot. And the way the Midrash portrays it is totally different than the way the pshat presents it. And that's very important. Both are, you have to understand it on both levels, right? I mean, I'll just say one thing now. Yosef, you know, whatever. But you think Yosef was such a tzaddik, that's why we call him Yosef HaTzaddik. You get it? He wasn't tzaddik on many levels, but on many levels, it's only because of Yosef that we were slaves in Egypt. I hope people understand that. That Yosef was the one who gave, why did Paro like Yosef? Here's a slave, a 30-year-old Hebrew Na'ar Eved Ivri, as the butler said, right? So why in the world? And that's why he said it, because he knew Paro was never going to listen to Na'ar Eved Ivri. I'll make you the butler, the head, right? That was the whole point of the butler. I was very politically smart. I'm going to help you, Paro, but at the same time, I'm going to know you're not going to listen to that idiot, that Na'ar Eved Ivri, and I'm going to become king. So why? In 1 second, wow, have you ever seen a smarter person in the world? Why did Paro like Yosef?
Maybe because he gave him power.
There you
like
go.
He ended up transferring
gave
all the
him
land.
Power where you're going to control all the land. I'm going to take away the land from every. Wow. This is great. Consolidating power. How do you think we became slaves? Now, that's unintended consequences. But that's what happened here. It's because of Yosef. Vayaka Melech. Yosef, he remembered the Yosef, you know, how Yosef gave him power. He just didn't remember the nice parts of Yosef. It's already in this week's Parsha. How long does Yosef live after Yaakov dies? Do the calculation. How many years does Yosef live after Yaakov dies? Okay, it's not hard. Yaakov comes down to Egypt at 130. Yosef is 39. We know he's 39 because 30 years when he comes to power, 7 years of plenty, 2 years. And so Yosef is 39. Yosef is 130. Yosef, Yaakov dies 30, 17 years later, 17 and 17. The first 17 years of Yosef's life, the last 17 years of Yaakov's life, they're together, 17 and 17. And so Yosef is 56 when Yaakov dies, 39 and 17
years.
In my grade three math is correct. Yosef is 56 years old. And if he's 56 years old, he lives to be 110. And in grade one, we learned 110 minus 56 is 54. Yosef lived 54 years. What did Yosef do those 54 years? He didn't have any power. He was a nobody. They got rid of him. But after 7 years, after Par got all his power, who needs Yosef now? We just throw him out. And therefore, when Yosef dies, they can't bury him in Egypt. He's got a plea to his, you know, you're going to be slaves here. So I'm just, I don't know. It's really unrelated. I mean, because it's the Parsha of the week, but we have to realize this. I only say this because very often we read the Torah only through Midrash. It's important. Obviously, we read the Torah. If we read the Torah literally, we are Christians. That's not Judaism. We read the Torah through Midrashim, but the Midrashim also know, but the also read it through the pshat. You have to understand why is the Medrash doing what it's doing. And the Medrash doesn't mean to do it to take away the pshat. The Medrash wants to add an additional layer to the pshat. And pshat and drush often contradict. And that's the big debate. That's what, you know, how do you deal with it? Rashbam even answered, why does it contradict, right? Why does the Torah say an eye for an eye if it never meant an eye for an eye? Right? There is a reason, because the Torah wants to tell us giving money isn't real compensation. Halakhically, you give compensation, but that's not compensation, an eye for an eye. So the Torah has to write an eye for an eye. That's the only thing. You have this all over the place. So you always have that. Why does the Torah make Esav into such a bad guy? He's not such a bad guy in the Torah. But in fact, I'm halfway through the Dvar Torah after I finish the shiur. Hopefully I'll finish it up. But that's what I'm writing about. Maybe you will read it. You won't read it. Who's worse in the Torah, Yishmael or the brothers? Who's worse? Who's better morally? Everybody's afraid to say anything. It's obvious Yishmael is way better. Reuben sleeps with his mother, his father's wife. Shimon and Levi wipe out a city. So much so, Yaakov curses these people on his deathbed. You know, on his deathbed, you want to say nice things to your kids. No, Reuven curses out. Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Yehuda's not much better. He sleeps with a prostitute. We're going to sell Joseph to Egypt. Well, these guys, and these are the founders of Klaus. What did Yishmael do? What did Yishmael do that was so bad? I don't know what he did. He laughed at Yitzchak. Okay, so he laughed at Yitzchak. Big deal. And the Ramban says, you know why Yishmael creates so much problems? It's Avraham and Sarah's fault. It's an amazing Ramban. It's unbelievable. If you don't believe me, because I wouldn't believe me either. If I didn't see with my own eyes, I don't have it on the screen. Maybe at the end I'll show it. Bereishit 16:6, and see what the Ramban says. It was the punishment for the way Sarah said. Avram says, Sarah, do whatever you want, Tucker. Just throw her out. I don't care what you do. And Scott, are you crazy? So God got really angry and he said, that's it. That's it. That's it. I'm going to have a nation that's going to subjugate you and oppress you that we see right now. So it's really powerful statements of Chazal. Chazal were not at all afraid to castigate, and that I know that's a strong word. I mean, you see what Rav Shimon Rafael Hirsch writes about Yitzchak and Rivka. He says, you know why Esav was Esav? Because they messed up in raising the kids. They thought they're twins. And we come from a religious home, so we're going to send them to the same yeshiva. They're going to go to the yeshiva Shem and Aver for 14 years. They're going to go learn in the yeshiva. You know what? Esav can't go to that yeshiva. Esav needs the yeshiva where they play basketball and they do other things, because he's not an Ish Tam Yosheva Olim. He's an Ish Sadeh. And they blew it. It's unbelievable. Hirsch writes, people are very upset, you know, in the yeshiva. How can Rav Shimon Rafael Hirsch say this? Okay, I come from the world where Shimon Rafael Hirsch can say this. And he's right. And so, whatever. But the Midrash, so that's the question. In other words, what's going on here? So I'm way... But whatever, it's very important to read, to understand what the rabbis are trying to do when they, I don't want to reread or reinterpret. We have to understand it on two levels. And what the Asara Haruge Malchut? The Asara Haruge Malchut is the Romans carrying out God's punishment for kidnapping. And right, what do we always do when we say there's bad things happen? That's what I want to talk about actually in a few minutes. I don't know if we'll get there today. But God gets angry, right? What is God? Again, I guess I'll mention now, and then we'll pick up on this. When God gets angry, so what do we say? Why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Everybody knew. Why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Everybody knew? Two words.
Binat Sina.
Okay, so that's whatever. One thing. So what? That's terrible. That's what we call in English blame the victim. That's a terrible thing today. The Beit HaMikdash goes, the Romans destroyed the temple. Well, blame the victim, the Jewish. That's terrible. How can you do that? So well, what are the rabbis doing? The rabbis knew the Romans destroyed the temple. They know it's not because of Sinekinim. The rabbis, as Rav Soloveitchik says, we deserve it. Yeah, so that's very hard to say we deserve it. Do we deserve the Holocaust? God forbid. Do we deserve what's going on now? We're the best people around. For 4,000 years, we've been, we have problems and we're not perfect. But the Jewish people are an amazing people. And the chesed we do is unparalleled. And I was, you know, and the tzedakah we give, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are honorary Jews. They do more than anybody. But once you get beyond a few of the people, they are tzaddiki umad olam, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, unbelievable, raising trillions of dollars for charity. And Warren Buffett, Taka lives in a, well, how old is he? 90, 96, 98. Warren Munger, his partner, just died now at 98 years old. Warren Buffett lives in, I don't know, a three-bedroom house. How big is his house in Omaha, Nebraska? Everybody knows he drives a 10-year-old car. He doesn't live a fancy life. He's an example how wealth doesn't go to your head. It's amazing. I've never met him, but we did have in Toronto a number of years ago the rabbi in Omaha, who was a rabbi in Omaha, Nebraska, and guess who spot the shul's chametz for Pesach every year? You guessed it, Warren Buffett. So that's somehow somebody, we got the Warren Buffett bought the chametz in Omaha, Nebraska. Isn't that cool? Okay, but we Jews are amazing. We're amazing. We're still Rav Levi Yitzchak Berdichev here. We are an amazing people. We don't deserve it. But God has higher standards for us. There is a double, it's not fair in the real world, but we are judged by a double standard by the world at large, of course, and by God. Yeah, God is medakdekim tzaddikim kechut hasa'ara, as our sages say. God is exacting with the righteous. And for in this case, va'amech kulam tzaddikim, all the Jewish people are righteous. Anybody who's remained a Jew for 4,000 years after the Holocaust is by definition righteous. So amech kulam tzaddikim. So God is medakdek. God is careful with the righteous. Kechut hasa'ara, like one hair. We do one little thing wrong and God gets angry at us. It's not fair. You're right. It's not fair. This world is not a fair world. But the rabbis aren't really blaming. The rabbis are saying, what can we do to improve? The rabbis understood. I don't think rabbis would get up. The rabbis, remember, rabbis, they're talking to themselves, right? Rabbis, in the Talmud, when they say these things, they're talking to themselves. They're not talking to us. They're talking, the rabbis saying to each other, What do we have to teach Jewish people so we can do better? You know what we have to teach? Unity. And obviously, anybody who has half a brain knows that there's a connection between the first 9 months of 2023 when we're in Israel and the last few months. It's not disconnected. I don't need a Navi, a prophet, to realize that what happened, there's a deep connection, which analysts write about, between what happened for 9 months every week and and what happened. That's it. So that's what the rabbis are saying. So much so, I'm going to have to come back, but since I'm on topic, let me jump to show you that everybody said the Talmud story, Sinat Chinam. You know what? That's one of 10% of the opinions. I just want to show you a piece of Gemara I made.
Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah.
I just want to point out that Chazal, I believe, were on a level that they could make pronouncements like that. Like today, I think nobody alive has.
I agree today there's nobody alive who can make such. I agree. No, I don't even know if I agree with you either. It depends how you understand it. We don't have any prophets. Only prophets could make those pronouncements. When we had Yeshayahu, so Yeshayahu says, if you don't feed the poor, what is it? Yeshayahu doesn't say you don't put it on tzitzis or you didn't do borer properly on Shabbos. Yeshayahu says, don't give bread to the poor, clothes to the naked. That's what God wants on Yom Kippur, right? We read Matir Yonah because God saw they changed. He didn't see their fasting. He saw they changed their way. So we don't have prophets. When we have prophets, then we can say we know because God tells us. Chazal didn't know. I don't believe that. No, Chazal didn't know. They were normal people. They made mistakes. Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. No, I'm sorry. However, but they were great people. They had great insight. They weren't telling us why it happened. That's what I'm saying. They were telling us lema. For what can we learn from this? Not lama, as Rav Soloveitchik says. Not why does it happen? What can we learn from that? And therefore, Chazal were saying we should learn not to do Sinat Binam. We should learn to learn Lifnei Mishur HaDin. I'll show you more in a moment. And I think that still applies nowadays in theory, but not in practice. You can't do that in practice because people don't understand that. People, if a rabbi got up, if somebody would, I sort of almost said it, I didn't exactly say it because I put it in political, military, whatever, economic spin, that, you know, the disunity of the Jewish people for the first 9 months of 2023, that is why the war is happening. So if you phrase it like that, people are going to yell at you. You're a disgusting person. How dare you say that? But if you say it that, you know, our enemies were looking at how weak and this was time to tell, then it makes a lot of sense. It's all how you phrase it. So when the rabbis said Sinat Chinam, all these things, they didn't mean, they didn't know why God is doing it. This is what we can learn from it. And I think that's still important. It's very hard to say that today. It's very, very hard to say that today. Matter of fact, I'll skip ahead. I know I actually put it, and I'll share it in one moment. I don't know if anybody read, I'm not sure. I agree with everything, but it's fascinating, the article. Josh Berman, who's a big Bible scholar, he's spoken for Torah Motion. He wrote the book recently on biblical criticism, sort of a traditional approach to biblical criticism. He's a professor at Bar-Ilan University, lives in Beit Shemesh, I believe. He's a, you know, big Talmid Chacham, I mean, whatever. He's an academic scholar, teach Bible. He's very much in our world. So he wrote an article last week in the Times of Israel. Let me show it to you. So I thought it's a fascinating article. Why don't I show it to you right now? Why is that not happening? Okay. Here's the article. Is this war divine punishment? So every morning, okay, very sad. Okay, terrible. Yeah, what's going on? Okay, our greatest text is affirmed at every stage of our history. He says like this. Okay, strikingly, our religious fund is something puts it as divide from those who preceded us. From the Bible through the shtetl, our forefathers believe when collective calamity fell us, we must stand before the Almighty in recognition of our failings, our sin. But there's very little talk of sin as the cause of our current crisis, even within religious circles. At every stage in history, our greatest texts have affirmed that collective calamity is caused by our own misdeeds. Every story in the Bible, okay, it's one thing to say in the Bible, teaches us this lesson. This notion was codified by Maimonides in the commandment to earth to cry out over a calamity that befalls the community. When calamity strikes and they cry out, all will know this because their misdeeds has befallen them. But if they, of course, the Rambam doesn't tell us which misdeed because we don't know, but the connection, you're right, this is the Rambam in the beginning of Laws of Fasting. Nothing distinguishes Sephardic and Ashkenazic liturgy more than this slichot, where Sephardic slichot speak about penance, Ashkenazic slichot speak about pogroms. And that's interesting. I don't know enough Sephardic things. And yet we are uncomfortable thinking this way around our current crisis. For some, after the Shoah, it is no longer possible to speak about Jewish suffering, result of sin. Rabbi Soloveitchik said it's blasphemy to say that the Holocaust is a result of sin. How dare we say that? That we're so evil that the Holocaust is right. So it is very, theology changes too. Others take a fiction that God would allow, let alone at least the mass atrocities. How are we to even know what our sins are? And then he's there in biblical times, prophet told Israel what our sins were. But we have no such prophets today. In fact, we take to heart our own sins that brought about this war. We are doomed to engage. This is really powerful. In English, finger pointing. Do we suffer because we uprooted settlements from Gush Katif or because we worked to weaken Palestinian authority in the West Bank? Is it because we haven't done enough to secure rights for LGBTQ members of our society or because we have normalized such identities? The list is potentially endless. We will affirm our own values with the assuredness that there is others who are in the wrong. Strikingly, none of these questions bothered our ancestors. Okay, you can read, though, you get the point. I think it's a very interesting article. Admitting our sins is especially critical, major fragmentation, right? But we should admit our sins, not admit somebody else's sins. So this is a very powerful idea. So I think it is very important to recognize we don't know why tragedy happens. We cannot know, as Rav Soloveitchik says, the theodicy, that's, you know, the fancy philosophical word, and why good things happen to bad people. That was, of course, Harold Kushner's famous book, and I know he wasn't an Orthodox rabbi, but he addressed that issue. That guy became, right, who remembers the book? It was a best-selling book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. His answer was unacceptable from a traditional point of view. It, basically, God doesn't intervene in the world. We don't accept that. We believe God does intervene. We just don't understand how and why. So we can't understand this, and that's why, as I mentioned, Rav Soloveitchik says, we don't ask lama, we ask lima, for what purpose, what can we learn? But I want to show you, to prove the point even more, so if we go back here, we will go now to a Gemara in Shabbat. That was 119. Amar Rav Avahu, lo charva Yerushalayim. By the way, this is the context is very fascinating. This is where Lechem Mishnah is, but okay, we won't talk about that now. Amar Rav Avahu, lo charva Yerushalayim should be Lukriyat Shema Kshafri Barbida. They didn't say Shema in the morning. That's why Jerusalem was destroyed. So there's obviously a deeper meaning here, which at this point doesn't interest me what it is. But we lost Jerusalem because we didn't say Shema. We didn't recognize God morning and evening. He quotes a verse. Very nice. Amar Rav HaMenuna, lo charva Yerushalayim el shibitlu batino kosher beirban. No, the schools, they gave off too much vacation on schools. Shibitlu batino kosher beirban. The students, they didn't learn enough Torah. That's a little different from Shema. Then we continue. Amar Rav Amram, read Rav Shimon, Amar Rav Shimon Baraba. Wow, this is a long tradition. You know why Jews didn't rebuke one another? I saw you doing something wrong. I minded my own business. No, I can't mind my own business. I have to tell you to do better. That's why Jerusalem was destroyed. And Amar Rav Yehuda said the name of Rav. Okay, fine. This whole thing about the importance, right? One of my favorite halachot, I don't know if it's here, that if they tell you that they're building the Beit HaMikdash, you don't quit learning Torah. Somebody else can build the Beit HaMikdash. Somebody else can greet the Mashiach. You're learning Torah, don't interrupt for the Mashiach. Big deal. So you'll meet the Mashiach later. It's amazing. Amar Rav Rava, lo charva Yerushalayim shiyoshev pasuk men anshei emunah. People weren't honest in business. People of integrity were lost. Everybody was a liar, a stab in the back. That's why Jerusalem was destroyed. And then, do we have more? You get the point, right? You get the point. And then my favorite one, if I can say that, Amar of Yochanan, lo charva, that was all in one Gemara. That was in Shabbos. Now, in Bava Metzia, the Gemara is talking about returning lost objects. That's the context of this Gemara. How important it is, whatever. Amar of Yochanan, lo charva Yerushalayim el shatana badin Torah. Jerusalem was destroyed because they followed the laws of the Torah. Now, this is an amazing statement. It's so amazing. The Gemara is like incredible. The reason Jerusalem was destroyed because people follow the Torah. That's why. Aladina de Magzita Lidlina. What are you, out of your mind? What should they do? How do they translate? Should they do arbitrary? I don't know if that's the right thing. Well, what should they do? The law of the marketplace? What are you, that's the greatest thing in the world. Well, they're all, nah. Ela Shemidu Dinaim al Din Torah Velo Abdul Nifni Mishur Din. Yeah, you know what? Sometimes the Torah law is terrible. They follow the Torah, exactly what the Torah says. The technical law is terrible. You have to do lifnim mishurat din. Sometimes you can't apply the Torah. Torah is given in generic terms. In your particular case, you have to. You're very wealthy, and the guy did an accident. He broke your window by mistake, and he's on poor. It's true. In a court, you're going to win, and the judge is forbidden from favoring the poor. That's a isur in the Torah, prohibition. But you know what? Don't go before the straightness of the law. Don't always enter the law. It's a beautiful thing. The Torah itself can lead to destruction. Following the Torah is not misused. Yep. And I didn't even touch upon Sinat Chinam. We didn't even discuss Sinat Chinam. Now, you can relate that. Unbelievable. What happened? The rabbis have no idea why the temple is destroyed. The rabbis have no idea what sin caused the temple, because we are not allowed to make such an assessment. How dare a human being say, we know why God did that? Only a fool. That's worse than a fool. Only an evil person can say such a thing. That this happened because this happened, you know, because I don't have to get into statements that some rabbis have said, you know, the movie theaters were open, the mezuzahs aren't kosher. Like, give me a break. We have no idea why this happens. But the rabbis understood something terrible. We have to do tshuva. We have to follow what the Rambam says. Obviously, yes, we do believe that our actions do make a difference in heaven. So how can we improve? How can we improve? So every rabbi is talking to his particular people. In this community, people didn't go to shul. They didn't say Shema day and night. In this community, the schools were weak. In this community, the business ethics were weak. And, you know, in this community, people were so focused on Torah, Dinei Torah, they lost the value of the Torah. Sometimes you can't apply it to lifnei mishurat hadin. So every rabbi is giving their own interpretation about what this sin is. But nobody is actually saying, they don't mean it literally. That's the problem. We read it, we don't understand it. Rabbis don't mean, this is why God destroyed Jerusalem. But then the rabbis, obviously, why would you listen to the rabbis? They don't have a clue. They don't know what they're talking about. Every rabbi has a different opinion, you know, and the more opinions they have means the less they know, right? That's the mentioned all the time. The Nachama Leibowitz famous, you know, idea, when Rashi gives two explanations, means neither are very good, or both are satisfactory, but they're not good enough. Because if one explanation is good, you don't need a second explanation. The Gemara will say that Yehuda Vodli Kram. Why do you have to give two reasons? Have one reason, it's good enough. When you have 16 reasons for something, means we don't know what the reason is at all. So I think that's a very important point. So the Torah is going to say, Becharat, God will get angry, and it's not going to rain anymore, and you're going to be exiled from the land. We don't really know why. And that's why I find it fascinating. How does the Torah describe what happened here? The Torah says it will stop raining. It's a very, again, we've talked at the beginning of the class, that the rewards of the Torah are very natural. It's going to rain, you'll have crops, your animals, everything's going to be great. And here the Torah says the exact opposite. It's not that enemies are going to come into your land. The Torah has that at other places. In the Tochacha, the Torah has your enemies will chase you, but not in the Shema. Very fascinating. I have to think about this more, and maybe you can help me. But in the Shema, there's no other people. It's all about your relationship with God. And if we, and here where it's the collective relationship to God, if the Jewish people do not follow the mitzvot, you know what? I will, and it's sort of, it's almost poetic language. If God could have said, I won't give rain. That's not what he says. He says, Atzarta Shemaim. It's just the language. And we don't, Atzarta Shemaim, he stopped the heavens. The lo yematar, it's redundant, you realize. Atzar the Shemaim, lo yematar is a redundancy. But I think it's a beautifully poetic. But you know what? If you don't do the mitzvot, okay, we'll take away the rain, and you'll be forced to leave the land, like Abraham was forced to leave the land, and like Yitzchak was about to leave the land. And Yaakov, that's what we're reading about. We went to Oniv, we were formed because there was famine in Israel. Now, are you going to blame that famine on the sins of the Jewish people? Nobody does that. What the Ramban does is he blames Abraham for going down to Egypt, right? The Ramban also, you have to read 16:6, what I told you about Yishmael, in context with 12:8 in Bereishis, where the Ramban says that Abraham going, God just said to go to the land of Israel, and now he's leaving because there's a little bit of not food. That chet chata gedola, he sinned a great skin bishgagan. Because of that, we had to go to Egypt. That's why that's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what the Ramban is saying about what the Avot did wrong. But Israel is always doesn't have rain. That's what Israel lacks water. The whole Middle East lacks water. And therefore, but God, so water is very much, and in the Torah, that's very much the way God, communicated with us was through rain. That's what all the time. We modern people have difficulty with this concept, right? We don't, it's hard for us to get our head around it. But that's what the Torah says all the time, that in Egypt, they don't have to worry about water. They have the Nile. We have to worry about water. And God will use water as a mechanism to tell if he's happy with us. Now, that doesn't work anymore. The same way we don't have problems. Why doesn't it work anymore? Because thank God we have desalination plates, and Israel is the world's superpower in water technology. And I've mentioned Israel recycles out of about 90% of its water. And the next best country, I think Spain, does about 25% of the world. That's like the difference between, greater than the difference between Babe Ruth and the next best baseball player. The difference between Israel and water technology and everybody else is like, unbelievable. So we don't have these problems anymore. So we did away with the whole Torah. It's wonderful. That's great. We're allowed to, encouraged to, and obligated to. We have to sit there. Oh, now we don't have a way for God to punish us by having no rain. No, that's not a Jewish approach. God says that Chava is going to have difficult pregnancy. No, you can do the Lamaze method or whatever they do. I don't know if it works 100%, but we can do what we can. Give an epidural, do whatever you can to make childbirth less painful. That's always, I don't care. I don't worry about God. God can take care of himself. God says he's going to bring punishment. We don't have a theology that therefore says it's bad for us to undo the punishment. No, not at all. But it goes in with the same thing. We don't have that direct line to God anymore. We don't have prophecy, and we don't even have rain to tell us. Now, when it doesn't rain, you should still fast. We spoke last week, when talking about Asarta, Masechet Tanit is about all the fasting when there's no rain. And Taka, if there's a drought, if there's a plague, if there's COVID, yeah, we should call a communal fast. And he said, that's the problem. We don't know why God is doing it. But on the other hand, we also don't do enough to acknowledge God. In other words, that God runs the world. We should, as my Avram Kowalski said on our Hanukkah program, why hasn't there been a universal fast day for the war going on now? Why hasn't every Hasidic Rebbe and every Rosh Yeshiva and every modern Orthodox rabbi and every Yeshiva University in Lakewood get together? Fast day, Slichus, Yom Kippur. So we don't do that anymore. That's also sad. We've so lost the idea that God does anything that we don't even really. So we say an extra prayer in Tehillim every day. I'll get to your question in a couple of one second. I happen not to be a big fan of this. I'm going to say my heresy again. I think there are in my shul, and they say Avinu Malkeinu every day, Shachrit and Mincha, including, it depends where I daven, but where I daven on Shabbos, where I mainly daven, and now that I'm off vacation from chat, so I've been to Clapton Park all week, but so there they only say it on Thursday at Mincha. I found that very strange, Monday, Thursday at Mincha, but in Orchheim they say it Monday, they say it Shachar Mincha, Shabbos, Shachar Mincha, so I happen to think it's a mistake. Because what ends up happening is Avinu Malkeinu, all these things, they become like, it's just an extra 3 minutes of davening that we don't pay attention to. You know what, actually, we say Tehillim every day when we daven, every day. And we say Tehillim Kaf Lam Natseach, Mizmor LeDavid, Yancha Hashem Be'et Sarah. Say that with extra kavana. So when we get to Ashrei Uvalitzion, say that pasuk by pasuk. But this adding on tefillot just becomes like people lose sight. And if you do it every day, it's meaningless. If you said Avinu Malkeinu once a week, Beseder. Anyways, that's my opinion. But yes, we should have a fast day. There should be a fast day for Yom HaShoah, whatever. But okay, Yocheved, yes, what do you want to say?
Okay, I was going to say something else. But by the way, a month or two ago, there was a fast. Fast
a little fast, yeah, but I heard about it after the fact.
Right.
So I think it is good. I think that was
right.
Good. Right.
So we tried.
Yeah, we tried. Right. But okay. Unfortunately, we couldn't unify the whole world to do that. Yeah. That's right. All you wanted to say?
Well, I wanted to say, V'yatsar es ha-shamayim, in a way, more positive than saying, I will not give you rain, because it sounds like there's rain up there, like I'm ready to give it to you, but I am just pausing it. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I'm just, you were saying, like, why does it use that poetic language?
It's a red light. And the light can't go green until we go, but it's going to be a long time because God's going to throw us out. Therefore, there won't be grain. And your va'avadata mehira. It's interesting, mehira. You'll va'avadata mehira. You'll be thrown out quickly. It's going to happen like out of the blue, like the war now, like totally unexpected. Va'avadata mehira, me'alarta. You're going to lose the land that God has given to you very quickly. Yeah, it's you know, we don't right. It's the rain is there. God is always wants to do chesed for us, but we have to let him. We have to let him do chesed. So right, but
I'm just reading that into the words. You know. Take it as
Think that's true. I think that's very true. Okay, I see it's getting late, so just let's quickly review we're going to the second half of the Shema. It's a negative side. Hishamru lechem, you have to be very, very careful. And by the way, the only sin mentioned in Shema is idolatry. Very interesting. Doesn't mention all these other moral, ethical sins. They may be somehow delineated from that connect, but the sin here in the Torah is you're going to forget about God. So we talked about the danger of wealth, the beauty of wealth, and the Torah knows though that wealth is much more dangerous than poverty. Nonetheless, we daven for wealth every day. Wealth is beautiful. We want wealth. It's very important. And the rewards of the Torah are very natural. Money, okay, money and crops. And because that's what most people can relate to. Or the Rambam adds a sort of a spiritual idea that with our physical needs taken care of, we can develop our spiritual needs. And it's true, people... That's the way it was always in history. People need money to support learning. So it's just a means to an end. But that's the Rambam's addition in the Torah itself. The rewards are all material. The Rambam is saying it's a stepping stone to spiritual, but that's a leap. I'm not saying it isn't true. I'm just saying that that's not what it says in the Torah itself. And then it's pen yifteh. When we open up, we are seduced, so to speak, by our money. Our money seduces us. We do all kinds of things we wouldn't otherwise do, and we forget that it's a partnership with God. There are people who are equally smart and work equally hard who aren't as successful, and that's why we have Shabbos every week, and that's why we have Brachot before it. That's why we have so many things to try to remind us that we are blessed with what we have, and it's not through Kochi Votzem Yad Yasali, but it's very hard, very hard. Man's natural tendency, and we discuss the influence of money on bias that we have, and subconscious bias that we're not even aware of, that now scientists are sort of revealing all the subconscious biases that we have through all the wonderful experiments they do. So the Torah and I think was well aware of this. The Torah and Chazal were light years ahead when they understood this problem, that even if you greet a judge in the morning, that can disqualify the judge from being on your case. Just that hello can, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. So what wealth can do, right? And if you pay, if a judge gets paid for every case he does, we're in big trouble. You've got to give him a nice salary because people do respect wealth. The Torah says the Kohen Gadol has to be wealthy. Judge, and then we discussed mainly the idea of God's punishments in the world. There was a time in history where we could identify our sin. That's when we had Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Amos, Micha, Yonah, all these people. We don't have them anymore. The Torah prophecy was given to the sages, was moved, not given to the sages. Prophecy was removed, and the sages took over. And the Gemara says, Chacham Adif Minavi. Sages are greater than prophets, but where there's more uncertainty, that's all, and we cannot know for sure. So we can no longer ask the question, Lama. We can only ask the question, Lema, for what purpose? What can we learn? And therefore, every rabbi learns a different thing. Sinat Chinam just happens to be the most famous thing that they learned from the second Beit HaMikdash. Gemara does seem to develop more, but we saw already 6-7 other reasons why Jerusalem might have been destroyed. So, and it's okay. We don't have to listen to what the Torah says, that rain is a mechanism for God to punish us. We're allowed to sort of say, God, you know, we don't need your rain anymore. We're going to develop on my own. I mean, I know that sounds a little bit harsh. I don't quite mean it that way, but in a sense, that is what we do. And that is beautiful. That's what the Torah wants us to do. That's raise our dignity, that we're not dependent on these things, but hopefully we can still come to recognize God, you know, when things are good. Okay, as I mentioned in the beginning, please God, next week I'll be in Yerushalayim, so I'll have the shiur earlier. I'll let you know the exact time, but I hope people can still come. I have to debate if we'll do maybe a different topic or whatever, but we'll see. But we'll start the shiur sometime between 8:15 and 8:30 in the morning, Eastern time, and I'll send out an email, and okay. To hear good news and good things, and want to wish everybody Shabbat Shalom, and Rabbi Liebtag and Benny Gesundheit on Sunday morning, and Mark Shapiro will be teaching also this Monday night also. Okay, and Rabbi Shulman's back on Tuesday. And we're putting together our sort of our new courses, new schedule for the winter series, as we call it. It's the second or third week in January. So we'll keep you posted about that. Okay, oh, let's see. There are a couple. Yes, Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. It's an amazing book. I love that book. Really, all our biases, and it's really a phenomenal book. And I said he developed all the psychology. He's the first psychologist in the Israeli army, and he set up a lot of the ways they assess, you know, soldiers very young, and of course, a Nobel Prize winner. And these, minimum baseball 720. Two people typed in minimum baseball salary. Beautiful. Median salary is 4.9. Whoa, 4.9 salary. Oh, that. The median's a lot less. $4.9 million for average, right? It's also unfair. It's skewed. You have one guy making $70 million a year, but you have 50 players making $1.5 million a year. But anyway, okay, nobody cares. Okay, please don't place Warren Buffett in the same category as a faithful client of Jeffrey Epstein. Okay, I'm not sure why you're upset at me, but that's okay. Who was a client of Jeff? I don't know. Jeffrey Epstein, no good. But Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, I think, are tzaddikim. If I'm saying, please correct me if I'm saying something that you don't like about that. But anyways, I think what they've done with the giving pledge and is unbelievable. And the amount they give all their wealth to charity and they commit to others, they really are a model for us. And okay, but I'm happy to hear any criticism. Somebody wrote to me privately. The comment in Toronto, numerous Hamas supporters to march through cities, Jewish neighborhoods. I haven't even heard about that, that they're planning to march through Jewish neighborhoods on Shabbat. You know what? I haven't looked at the paper yet this morning. Usually I do all the time. I have such a better day when I don't look at the newspaper. I just prefer, you know, it's like unbelievable. It's so depressing reading the paper. So I just, you know, yes, Toronto's a lot of parades. I haven't heard about that. And hopefully the police have been amazing in Toronto. I think they have stations all over the place. And there have been a lot of support demonstrations of Hamas. There have been in Toronto. They've been everywhere in New York City. They're all over the place, unfortunately. It's sad. It's sad and a little scary. But okay, what can we do? I think a lot we can do is education. I think a lot of these people really it's bad, but I think a lot of them really just don't know. And I think we can't give up that education can help. But whatever. Listen, Toronto is where Apartheid Week started. Israel Apartheid Week started at University of Toronto. Toronto's a nice place to hope. Non-tang disparage Jews is Rahmani by Shannon Gomez Khassanim. Can we dismiss? No, we cannot dismiss non-Jews. Non-Jews can be like that. There are many apart from Warren Buffett. Yeah, of course. There are many wonderful non-Jews in the world. 100%. Yes. There are many wonderful non-Jews in the world. Okay, I just saw the Archdiocese of New Orleans asked the Christians to fast. Whoa. See, yeah, there you go. That's interesting. Joining Catholics all around the world. Listen, the last year, it wasn't so nice, but Netanyahu or Dermer, one of the people said, forget the American Jews. We want to work with the evangelicals. They're much more supportive because American Jews are liberal by and large, you know, and therefore we're against the judicial overall. So when they want, he said, forget those liberal Jews. Let's work. Remember that? They said that a few months ago. And there's a lot of criticism about that. They should put the Jews first. I hear that. But it is true that the evangelical Christians, most of them are very big supporters of Israel. And Baruch Hashem, Joe Biden is a tzaddik. I think we have to say that what Joe Biden is doing is unbelievable. He's the only one. He's standing up for Israel. And I saw yesterday, I did look at the paper, that there was a readout that he's furious at Netanyahu, that Netanyahu he canceled the meeting to discuss the day after Gaza because a Smotrich, you know, it's after class, we can talk a little politics. He canceled the meeting there and Biden's furious and he says, I stand up for you every day. He's probably going to lose the election over this, which is a scary thought. But he can lose the election over this. And the whole world is condemning Israel. Biden 100% supports Israel. And Netanyahu, you know, he spits in his face. And everything that Biden asks for Netanyahu publicly says, no, I don't agree with you. There's a big problem here. We can't be so arrogant. Jews learned. We learned throughout history. That was always the approach. We kneel. Yaakov Avinu kneeled before Esav. So the Ramban criticizes him. Okay, Beseder. But we know the approach of Jewish history. Yeah, I have to balance it. I know the exact approach. We have to have deference to Malchut. We have to have deference to non-Jews. That's always been the classical approach, and that is the proper Jewish approach. So I think Biden is supported. And believe me, if Biden decides tomorrow that Israel cannot continue the war will end, and Hamas will be in power, because Israel cannot fight without U.S. help. And I think people realize that Israel doesn't have enough arms. It's sad, but Israel is totally unprepared. But without U.S. arms, shipments, Israel will be finished. So I think Biden should get a big yashar koach. And I don't care if you're a Democrat, Republican, if you care about Israel, what Biden is doing is unbelievable. Okay, Gates was a regular visitor, Jeffrey Epstein. Okay, I'm sorry to hear that. Listen, what's his name? The owner of the New England Patriots also did not nice things, but a big supporter of Israel. People are very complex, right? No, somebody wrote to me privately, Gates was a visitor to Jeffrey Epstein's island for Trisha's underage girl. I don't know if that's true at all. It might be true. I have no idea. I haven't heard that before. And it's not relevant to the amount of charity and all the good he does, right? The Talmud says that a sota, a woman who committed adultery, will have her punishment delayed if she has many merits. A person can commit adultery and have merits. That's what the Gemara says. That's the whole thing. Can a woman learn Torah? Because it says in the Torah she's going to die. Her thighs are going to bloat and all that. And the Gemara says, no. But if she has merit, she's otherwise righteous. Yeah, she committed adultery. Okay. But she's otherwise righteous. So I think that's an amazing statement of the Talmud. You can commit adultery and otherwise be righteous. So I don't know what Bill Gates did in his private life, and he's divorced from his wife, but what he's doing for Tzedakah is amazing, and we have to know Havdalah, Chokhmah, to wisdom means to distinguish, and that we do good and bad. But I do think what they're doing in terms of Tzedakah is amazing, and I haven't heard anybody say bad things on Warren Buffett in terms of his moral level, and he lives a simplistic life. But anyways, yes, we Jews should always try to do best, okay? I hope that answers you, and if you're still upset, that's fine. You still disagree, that's Beseder, Gamur, but that is what I think. And even if they do adultery, and it's terrible that it is, they have to be punished for that. It doesn't mean they haven't done any good, okay? We stop now with enough of my whatever. Please feel free to disagree. You can argue with me. I don't want to, you know. I'm just expressing my opinion. I think Joe Biden's been unbelievable, unbelievable. And
and I'm known as a big West Winger and part of it, but I agree with you about baseball, but I think that if I gotta say it this way, if it seems to me that what become obvious is that the real choice in the world now.
There's a real what in the world now?
C-H-O-I.
That's terrible. What's going on in the world now is absolutely terrible.
Let me say this, okay? There's a choice between Chobani and capitalism and Stalin and Harvard. And if I gotta take one of those two, I'd rather take Chobani.
You'd rather take Ohtani. Is that what you're saying? Ohtani paid, yeah, listen, whatever. Listen, I said, if somebody paid me $700 million to play baseball, I mean, I don't know. It might be 7 cents. I mean, but whatever. Anyways, the world is a complex place. What can I say? I got to just try our best. Okay, everybody, hope to see you soon. Good occasions. Sort of. Shabbat shalom, everybody. Thank you very much.